Disc 4.
Chapter 13. "It's so very kind of you to have asked me to take tea with you," said Miss Marple to Emma Crackenthorpe. Miss Marple was looking particularly woolly and fluffy, a picture of a sweet old lady. She beamed as she looked round her, at Harold Crackenthorpe in his well-cut dark suit, at Alfred handing her sandwiches with a charming smile, at Cedric standing by the mantelpiece in a ragged tweed jacket scowling at the rest of his family. "We are very pleased that you could come," said Emma politely. There was no hint of the scene which had taken place after lunch that day when Emma had exclaimed, "Oh, dear me, I quite forgot. I told Miss Islesbarrow that she could bring her old aunt to tea today."
"Put her off," said Harold brusquely. "We've still got a lot to talk about. We don't want strangers here."
"Well, let her have tea in the kitchen or somewhere with the girl," said Alfred. "Oh, no, I couldn't do that," said Emma firmly. "That would be very rude."
"Oh, let her come," said Cedric. "We can draw her out a little about the wonderful Lucy. I should like to know more about that girl, I must say. I'm not sure that I trust her. Too smart by half."
"She is very well connected and quite genuine," said Harold. "I've made it my business to find out. One wanted to be sure. Poking about and finding the body the way she did."
"If we only knew who this damned woman was," said Alfred. Harold added angrily,
"I must say, Emma, that I think you were out of your senses going and suggesting to the police that the dead woman might be Edmund's French girlfriend. It will make them convinced that she came here and that probably one or other of us killed her."
"Oh, no, Harold, don't exaggerate."
"Harold's quite right," said Alfred. "Whatever possessed you, I don't know. I've a feeling I'm being followed everywhere I go by plainclothes men." "I told her not to do it," said Cedric. "Then Quimper backed her up."
"It's no business of his," said Harold angrily. "Let him stick to pills and powders and national health."
"Oh, do stop quarrelling," said Emma wearily. "I'm really glad this old Miss What's-her-name is coming to tea. It will do us all good to have a stranger here and be prevented from going over and over the same things again and again. I must go and tidy myself up a little." She left the room.
"This Lucy Islesbarrow," said Harold, and stopped. "As Cedric says, it is odd that she should nose about in the barn and go opening up a sarcophagus. It's a really Herculean task. Perhaps we ought to take steps." "Her attitude, I thought, was rather antagonistic at lunch."
"Leave her to me," said Alfred. "I'll soon find out if she's up to anything."
"I mean, why? Open up that sarcophagus."
"Perhaps she isn't really Lucy Islesbarrow at all," suggested Cedric.
"But what would be the point?"
Harold looked thoroughly upset. "Oh, damn." They looked at each other with worried faces. "And here's this pestilential old woman coming to tea just when we want to think."
"We'll talk things over this evening," said Alfred. "In the meantime, we'll pump the old aunt about Lucy."
So Miss Marple had duly been fetched by Lucy and installed by the fire, and she was now smiling up at Alfred as he handed her sandwiches, with the approval she always showed towards a good-looking man.
"Thank you so much. May I ask? Oh, egg and sardine, yes, that will be very nice. I'm afraid I'm always rather greedy over my tea, as one gets on, you know, and of course, at night, only a very light meal. I have to be careful."
She turned to her hostess once more.
"What a beautiful house you have, and so many beautiful things in it. Those bronzes, now, they remind me of some my father bought at the Paris exhibition."
"Really, your grandfather did?
In the classical style, aren't they? Very handsome. How delightful for you having your brothers with you. So often families are scattered. India, though I suppose that is all done with now. And Africa, the West Coast, such a bad climate.
Two of my brothers live in London."
"Oh, that is very nice for you. But my brother Cedric is a painter and lives in Ibiza, one of the Balearic Islands." Painters are so fond of islands, are they not? Said Miss Marple. Chopin, that was Majorca, was it not? Ah, but he was a musician. It is Gauguin I'm thinking of. A sad life, misspent, one feels. I myself never really care for paintings of native women, and although I know he is very much admired, I have never cared for that lurid mustard colour. One really feels quite bilious looking at his pictures. She eyed Cedric with a slightly disapproving air.
Tell us about Lucy as a child, Miss Marple, said Cedric.
She smiled up at him delightedly. Oh, Lucy was always so clever, she said. Yes, you were, dear. Now, don't interrupt. Quite remarkable at arithmetic. Why, I remember when the butcher overcharged me for topside of beef.
Miss Marple launched full steam ahead into reminiscences of Lucy's childhood, and from there to experiences of her own in village life. The stream of reminiscence was interrupted by the entry of Brian and the boys, rather wet and dirty as a result of an enthusiastic search for clues. Tea was brought in, and with it came Dr. Quimper, who raised his eyebrows slightly as he looked round after acknowledging his introduction to the old lady.
Hope your father's not under the weather, Emma.
Oh, no. That is, he was just a little tired this afternoon. Avoiding visitors, I expect, said Miss Marple with a roguish smile. How well I remember my own dear father. Got a lot of old pussies coming, he would say to my mother. Send my tea into the study. Very naughty about it, he was.
Oh, please don't think, began Emma, but Cedric cut in. It's always tea in the study when his dear son's come down. Psychologically to be expected, eh, Doctor?
Dr. Quimper, who was devouring sandwiches and coffee cake with the frank appreciation of a man who has usually too little time to spend on his meals, said,
Psychology's all right if it's left to the psychologist. Trouble is, everyone is an amateur psychologist nowadays. My patients tell me exactly what complexes and neuroses they're suffering from, without giving me a chance to tell them. Thanks, Emma. I will have another cup. No time for lunch today.
A doctor's life, I always think, is so noble and self-sacrificing, said Miss Marple.
You can't know many doctors, said Dr. Quimper. Leeches, they used to be called, and leeches they often are. At any rate, we do get paid nowadays. The state sees to that. No sending in of bills that you know won't ever be met. Trouble is that all one's patients are determined to get everything they can out of the government, and as a result, if little Jenny coughs twice in the night or little Tommy eats a couple of green apples, out the poor doctor has to come in the middle of the night. Oh, well, glorious cake, Emma. What a cook you are.
Not mine. Miss Islesbarrow's.
You make 'em just as good, said Quimper loyally.
Will you come and see my father?
She rose, and the doctor followed her.
Miss Marple watched them leave the room. Miss Crackenthorpe is a very devoted daughter, I see, she said.
Can't imagine how she sticks the old man herself, said the outspoken Cedric. She has a very comfortable home here, and father is very much attached to her, said Harold quickly. Oh, Em's all right, said Cedric. Born to be an old maid.
There was a faint twinkle in Miss Marple's eye as she said, Oh, do you think so?
Harold said quickly, My brother didn't use the term old maid in any derogatory sense, Miss Marple.
Oh, I wasn't offended, said Miss Marple. I just wondered if he was right. I shouldn't say myself that Miss Crackenthorpe would be an old maid. She's the type, I think, that's quite likely to marry late in life and make a success of it.
Not very likely living here, said Cedric. Never sees anybody she could marry.
Miss Marple's twinkle became more pronounced than ever. There are always clergymen and doctors. Her eyes, gentle and mischievous, went from one to another.
It was clear that she had suggested to them something that they had never thought of and which they did not find over-pleasing.
Miss Marple rose to her feet, dropping, as she did so, several little woolly scarves and her bag. The three brothers were most attentive, picking things up. So kind of you, fluted Miss Marple. Oh, yes, and my little blue muffler. Yes, as I say, so kind
to ask me here. I've been picturing, you know, just what your home was like, so that I can visualize dear Lucy working here.
Perfect home conditions, with murder thrown in, said Cedric. Cedric? Harold's voice was angry.
Miss Marple smiled up at Cedric. You know who you remind me of? Young Thomas Ede, our bank manager's son. Always out to shock people. It didn't do in banking circles, of course, so he went to the West Indies. He came home when his father died and inherited quite a lot of money. So nice for him. He was always better at spending money than making it.
Lucy took Miss Marple home. On her way back, a figure stepped out of the darkness and stood in the glare of the headlights just as she was about to turn into the back lane. He held up his hand, and Lucy recognized Alfred Crackenthorpe.
That's better, he observed as he got in. Brrr, it's cold. I fancied I'd like a nice bracing walk. I didn't.
Taking the old lady home, all right?
Yes. She enjoyed herself very much.
One could see that.
Funny odd a taste old ladies have for any kind of society, however dull. And really nothing could be duller than Rutherford Hall. 2 days here is as much as I can stand. How'd you manage to stick it out, Lucy? Don't mind if I call you Lucy, do you?
Not at all.
I don't find it dull. Of course, with me it's not a permanency.
I've been watching you. You're a smart girl, Lucy.
Too smart to waste yourself cooking and cleaning.
Thank you, but I prefer cooking and cleaning to the office desk.
Well, so would I. But there are other ways of living. You could be freelance.
I am.
Not this way. I mean, working for yourself, pitting your wits against...
Against what?
The powers that be. All the silly pettifogging rules and regulations that hamper us all nowadays. The interesting thing is there's always a way round them if you're smart enough to find it, and you're smart. Come now. Does the idea appeal to you?
Possibly.
Lucy manoeuvred the car into the stable yard.
Not going to commit yourself?
I'd have to hear more.
Frankly, my dear girl, I could use you.
You've got the sort of manner that's invaluable, creates confidence.
Do you want me to help you sell gold bricks?
Oh, nothing so risky. Just a little bypassing of the law, no more.
His hand slipped up her arm. You're a damned attractive girl, Lucy. I'd like you as a partner.
I'm flattered.
Meaning nothing doing?
Think about it. Hey, think of all the fun. The pleasure you'd get out of outwitting all the sobersides.
The trouble is, one needs capital.
I'm afraid I haven't got any.
Oh, it wasn't a touch.
Oh, well, I'll be laying my hands on some before long.
My revered papa can't live forever, mean old brute. When he pops off, I'll lay my hands on some real money.
What about it, Lucy?
What are the terms?
Marriage, if you fancy it.
Women seem to, no matter how advanced and self-supporting they are. Besides, married women can't be made to give evidence against their husbands.
Not so flattering.
Oh, come off it, Lucy.
Don't you realize I've fallen for you?
Rather to her surprise, Lucy was aware of a queer fascination. There was a quality of charm about Alfred, perhaps due to sheer animal magnetism. She laughed and slipped from his encircling arm.
This is no time for dalliance. There's dinner to think about.
So there is, Lucy. And you're a lovely cook.
What's for dinner?
Wait and see. You're as bad as the boys.
They entered the house, and Lucy hurried to the kitchen.
She was rather surprised to be interrupted in her preparations by Harold Crackenthorpe.
Miss Islesborough, can I speak to you about something?
Would later do, Mr. Crackenthorpe. I'm rather behind hand.
Oh, certainly, certainly. After dinner?
Yes, that will do.
Dinner was duly served and appreciated.
Lucy finished washing up, and came out into the hall to find Harold Crackenthorpe waiting for her. "Yes, Mr. Crackenthorpe?"
"Shall we come in here?"
He opened the door of the drawing-room and led the way. He shut the door behind her.
"I shall be leaving early in the morning," he explained, "but I want to tell you how struck I have been by your ability."
"Thank you," said Lucy, feeling a little surprised.
"I feel that your talents are wasted here, definitely wasted."
"Do you? I don't. At any rate, he can't ask me to marry him," thought Lucy. "He's got a wife already."
"I suggest that, having very kindly seen us through this lamentable crisis, you call upon me in London. If you will ring up and make an appointment, I will leave instructions with my secretary. The truth is, we could use someone of your outstanding ability in the firm. We could discuss fully in what field your talents would be most ably employed. I can offer you, Miss Islesborough, a very good salary indeed, with brilliant prospects. I think you will be agreeably surprised."
His smile was magnanimous. Lucy said demurely, "Thank you, Mr. Crackenthorpe. I'll think about it."
"Don't wait too long. These opportunities should not be missed by a young woman anxious to make her way in the world."
Again his teeth flashed.
"Good night, Miss Islesborough. Sleep well."
"Well," said Lucy to herself, "well, this is all very interesting." On her way up to bed, Lucy encountered Cedric on the stairs.
"Look here, Lucy, there's something I want to say to you."
"Do you want me to marry you and come to Ibiza and look after you?"
Cedric looked very much taken aback and slightly alarmed. "I never thought of such a thing."
"Sorry, my mistake.
I just wanted to know if you've a timetable in the house."
"Oh, is that all? There's one on the hall table."
"You know," said Cedric reprovingly, "you shouldn't go about thinking everyone wants to marry you. You're quite a good-looking girl, but not as good-looking as all that. There's a name for that sort of thing. It grows on you and you get worse. Actually, you're the last girl in the world I should care to marry. The last girl."
"Indeed," said Lucy. "You needn't rub it in. Perhaps you'd prefer me as a stepmother."
"What's that?"
Cedric stared at her, stupefied. "You heard me," said Lucy, and went into her room and shut the door. Chapter 14. Dermot Craddock was fraternizing with Armand Dessin of the Paris Prefecture. The two men had met on one or two occasions and got on well together. Since Craddock spoke French fluently, most of their conversation was conducted in that language. "It is an idea only," Dessin warned him. "I have a picture here of the corps de ballet. That is she, the fourth from the left. It says anything to you, yes?" Inspector Craddock said that actually it didn't. A strangled young woman is not easy to recognize, and in this picture all the young women concerned were heavily made up and were wearing extravagant bird headdresses. "It could be," he said. "I can't go further than that. Who was she? What do you know about her?"
"Almost less than nothing," said the other cheerfully. "She was not important, you see. And the ballet Meritsky is not important either. It plays in suburban theatres and goes on tour. It has no real names, no stars, no famous ballerinas. But I will take you to see Madame Joliet, who runs it." Madame Joliet was a brisk, business-like Frenchwoman with a shrewd eye, a small moustache, and a good deal of adipose tissue. "Me, I do not like the police," she scowled at them, without camouflaging her dislike of the visit. "Always, if they can, they make me embarrassment."
"And no, no, madame, you must not say that," said Dessin, who was a tall, thin, melancholy-looking man.
"When have I ever caused you embarrassment?" "Over that little fool who drank the carbolic acid," said Madame Joliet promptly. "And all because she has fallen in love with the chef d'orchestre. who does not care for women and has other tastes. Over that, you made the big brouhaha, which is not good for my beautiful ballet. On the contrary, big box office business, said Dessin. And that was 3 years ago. You should not bear malice. Now, about this girl, Anna Stravinska. Well, what about her? Said Madame cautiously. Is she Russian? Asked Inspector Craddock. No, indeed. You mean because of her name? But they all call themselves names like that, these girls. She was not important. She did not dance well. She was not particularly good-looking. Elle était assez bien, c'est tout. She danced well enough for the corps de ballet, but no solos. Was she French? Perhaps. She had a French passport, but she told me once that she had an English husband. She told you that she had an English husband? Alive or dead? Madame Joliet shrugged her shoulders. Dead, or he had left her? How should I know which? These girls, there is always some trouble with men. When did you last see her? I take my company to London for 6 weeks. We play at Torquay, at Bournemouth, at Eastbourne, at somewhere else I forget, and at Hammersmith. Then we come back to France. But Anna, she does not come. She sends a message only that she leaves the company, that she goes to live with her husband's family, some nonsense of that kind. I do not think it is true myself. I think it is more likely that she has met a man. You understand? Inspector Craddock nodded. He perceived that that was what Madame Joliet would invariably think. And it is no loss to me. I do not care. I can get girls just as good and better to come and dance. So I shrugged the shoulders, and I do not think of it any more. Why should I? They are all the same, these girls, mad about men. What date was this? When we returned to France? It was, the Sunday before Christmas. And Anna, she leaves 2 or is it 3 days before that? I cannot remember exactly. But at the end of the week at Hammersmith, we have to dance without her, and it means rearranging things. It was very naughty of her, but these girls, the moment they meet a man, they are all the same. Only I say to everybody, zut, I do not take her back, that one. Very annoying for you. Ah, me, I do not care. No doubt she passes the Christmas holiday with some man she has picked up. It is not my affair. I can find other girls, girls who will leap at the chance of dancing in the ballet Beletsky, and who can dance as well or better than Anna. Madame Joliet paused, and then asked with a sudden gleam of interest, why do you want to find her? Has she come into money? On the contrary, said Inspector Craddock politely, we think she may have been murdered. Madame Joliet relapsed into indifference. Ça se peut. It happens. Ah, well, she was a good Catholic. She went to Mass on Sundays and no doubt to confession. Did she ever speak to you, madame, of a son? A son? Do you mean she had a child? That, now, I should consider most unlikely. These girls, all of them, know a useful address to which to go. Monsieur Dessin knows that as well as I do. She may have had a child before she adopted a stage life, said Craddock. During the war, for instance. Ah, dans la guerre. That is always possible. But if so, I know nothing about it. Who amongst the other girls were her closest friends? I can give you 2 or 3 names, but she was not very intimate with anyone. They could get nothing else useful from Madame Joliet. Shown the compact, she said Anna had one of that kind, but so had most of the other girls. Anna had perhaps bought a fur coat in London. She did not know. Me? I occupy myself with the rehearsals, with the stage lighting, with all the difficulties of my business. I have not time to notice what my artists wear. After Madame Joliet, they interviewed the girls whose names she had given them.
One or two of them had known Anna fairly well, but they all said that she had not been one to talk much about herself, and that when she did, it was, so one girl said, mostly lies.
She liked to pretend things. Stories about having been the mistress of a grand duke, or of a great English financier, or how she worked for the resistance in the war. There's even a story about being a film star in Hollywood. Another girl said, I think that really she had had a very tame bourgeois existence. She liked to be in the ballet because she thought it was romantic. But she was not a good dancer. You understand that if she were to say, my father was a draper in Amiens, that would not be romantic. So, instead, she made up things. Even in London, said the first girl, she threw out hints about a very rich man who was going to take her on a cruise round the world because she reminded him of his dead daughter who had died in a car accident. Quelle blague! She told me she was going to stay with a rich lord in Scotland, said the second girl. She said she would shoot the deer there. None of this was helpful. All that seemed to emerge from it was that Anna Stravinska was a proficient liar. She was certainly not shooting deer with a peer in Scotland, and it seemed equally unlikely that she was on the sun deck of a liner cruising round the world. But neither was there any real reason to believe that her body had been found in a sarcophagus at Rutherford Hall. The identification by the girls and Madame Joliet was very uncertain and hesitating. It looked something like Anna, they all agreed, but really, all swollen up, it might be anybody. The only fact that was established was that on the 19th of December, Anna Stravinska had decided not to return to France, and that on the 20th of December, a woman resembling her in appearance had travelled to Brackhampton by the 4:33 train and had been strangled. If the woman in the sarcophagus was not Anna Stravinska, where was Anna now? To that, Madame Joliet's answer was simple and inevitable. With a man. And it was probably the correct answer, Craddock reflected ruefully. One other possibility had to be considered, raised by the casual remark that Anna had once referred to having an English husband. Had that husband been Edmund Crackenthorpe? It seemed unlikely, considering the word picture of Anna that had been given him by those who knew her. What was much more probable was that Anna had at one time known the girl Martine sufficiently intimately to be acquainted with the necessary details. It might have been Anna who wrote that letter to Emma Crackenthorpe, and if so, Anna would have been quite likely to have taken fright at any question of an investigation. Perhaps she had even thought it prudent to sever her connection with the Ballymaritzky. Again, where was she now? And again, inevitably, Madame Joliet's answer seemed the most likely. With a man. Before leaving Paris, Craddock discussed with Dessin the question of the woman named Martine. Dessin was inclined to agree with his English colleague that the matter had probably no connection with the woman found in the sarcophagus. All the same, he agreed, the matter ought to be investigated. He assured Craddock that the Sûreté would do their best to discover if there actually was any record of a marriage between Lieutenant Edmund Crackenthorpe of the 4th Southshire Regiment and a French girl whose Christian name was Martine, time just prior to the fall of Dunkirk. He warned Craddock, however, that a definite answer was doubtful. The area in question had not only been occupied by the Germans at almost exactly that time, but subsequently, that part of France had suffered severe war damage at the time of the invasion. Many buildings and records had been destroyed. But rest assured, my dear colleague, we shall do our best. With this, he and Craddock took leave of each other. On Craddock's return, Sergeant Weatherall was waiting to report with gloomy relish. Accommodation address, sir. That's what 126 Elvis Crescent is.
Quite respectable and all that. Any identifications?
Nobody could recognise the photograph as that of a woman who'd called for letters. But I don't think they would anyway. It's a month ago, Vania, and a good many people use the place. It's actually a boarding house for students.
She might have stayed there under another name.
Or if so, they didn't recognise her as the original of the photograph. He added, we circularised the hotels, nobody registering as Martine Crackenthorpe anywhere. I'll receive your call from Paris. We checked up on Anna Stravinska. She was registered with other members of the company in a cheap hotel off Brook Green. Mostly theatricals there. She cleared out on the night of Thursday the 19th after the show. No further record.
Craddock nodded. He suggested a line of further inquiries, though he had little hope of success from them. After some thought, he rang up Wimborne, Henderson and Carstairs and asked for an appointment with Mr. Wimborne. In due course, he was ushered into a particularly airless room where Mr. Wimborne was sitting behind a large, old-fashioned desk covered with bundles of dusty-looking papers. Various deed boxes labelled Sir John Folds, deceased, Lady Derrin, George Rowbottom, Esquire, ornamented the walls, whether as relics of a bygone era or as part of present-day legal affairs, the inspector did not know. Mr. Wimborne eyed his visitor with the polite wariness characteristic of a family lawyer towards the police. What can I do for you, Inspector?
This letter. Craddock pushed Martine's letter across the table. Mr. Wimborne touched it with a distasteful finger, but did not pick it up. His colour rose very slightly, and his lips tightened.
Quite so, he said.
Quite so.
I received a letter from Miss Emma Crackenthorpe yesterday morning, informing me of her visit to Scotland Yard and of all the circumstances. I must say that I am at a loss to understand, quite at a loss, why I was not consulted about this letter at the time of its arrival. That's most extraordinary. I should have been informed immediately. Inspector Craddock repeated soothingly such platitudes as seemed best calculated to reduce Mr. Wimborne to an amenable frame of mind.
I'd no idea that there was ever any question of Edmund's having married, said Mr. Wimborne in an injured voice.
Inspector Craddock said that he supposed, in wartime, and left it to trail away vaguely.
Wartime, snapped Mr. Wimborne with waspish acerbity. Yes, indeed. We were in Lincoln's Inn Fields at the outbreak of war, and there was a direct hit on the house next door, and a great number of our records there were destroyed. Not the really important documents, of course. They had been removed to the country for safety. But it caused a great deal of confusion. Of course, the Crackenthorpe business was in my father's hands at that time. He died 6 years ago. I dare say he may have been told about this so-called marriage of Edmund's. But on the face of it, it looks as though that marriage, even if contemplated, never took place. And so, no doubt, my father did not consider the story of any importance. I must say, all this sounds very fishy to me. This coming forward after all these years and claiming a marriage and a legitimate son. Very fishy indeed.
What proofs had she got, I'd like to know.
Just so, said Craddock. What would her position or her son's position be?
The idea was, I suppose, that she would get the Crackenthorpes to provide for her and for the boy.
Yes, but I meant, what would she and the son be entitled to, legally speaking, if she could prove her claim?
Oh, I see. Mr. Wimborne picked up his spectacles, which he had laid aside in his irritation, and put them on, staring through them at Inspector Craddock with shrewd attention.
Well, at the moment, nothing. But if she could prove that the boy was the son of Edmund Crackenthorpe, born in lawful wedlock, then the boy would be entitled to his share of Josiah Crackenthorpe's trust on the death of Luther Crackenthorpe.
More than that, he'd inherit Rutherford Hall, since he's the son of the eldest son.
Would anyone want to inherit the house?
To live in?
I should say certainly not.
But that estate, my dear Inspector, is worth a considerable amount of money. Very considerable. Land for industrial and building purposes. Land which is now in the heart of Brackhampton. Oh, yes. A very considerable inheritance. If Luther Crackenthorpe dies, I believe you told me that Cedric gets it. He inherits the real estate, yes, as the eldest surviving son. Cedric Crackenthorpe, I have been given to understand, is not interested in money. Mr. Wimborne gave Craddock a cold stare. Indeed. I am inclined myself to take statements of such a nature with what I might term a grain of salt. There are doubtless certain unworldly people who are indifferent to money. I myself have never met one. Mr. Wimborne obviously derived a certain satisfaction from this remark. Inspector Craddock hastened to take advantage of this ray of sunshine. Harold and Alfred Crackenthorpe, he ventured, seem to have been a good deal upset by the arrival of this letter. Well, they might be, said Mr. Wimborne. Well, they might be. It would reduce their eventual inheritance? Certainly. Edmund Crackenthorpe's son, always presuming there is a son, would be entitled to a fifth share of the trust money. That doesn't really seem a very serious loss. Mr. Wimborne gave him a shrewd glance. It is a totally inadequate motive for murder, if that is what you mean. But I suppose they're both pretty hard up, Craddock murmured. He sustained Mr. Wimborne's sharp glance with perfect impassivity. Oh, so the police have been making inquiries? Yes, Alfred is almost incessantly in low water. Occasionally his very flush of money for a short time, but it soon goes. Harold, as you seem to have discovered, is at present somewhat precariously situated. In spite of his appearance of financial prosperity, it's facade. All facade. Half these city concerns don't even know if they're solvent or not. Balance sheets can be made to look all right to the inexpert eye, but when the assets that are listed aren't really assets, when those assets are trembling on the brink of a crash, I mean, where are you? Where, presumably, Harold Crackenthorpe is, in bad need of money. Well, he wouldn't have got it by strangling his late brother's widow, said Mr. Wimborne. And nobody's murdered Luther Crackenthorpe, which is the only murder that would do the family any good. So really, Inspector, I don't quite see where your ideas are leading you. The worst of it was, Inspector Craddock thought, that he wasn't very sure himself. Chapter 15. Inspector Craddock had made an appointment with Harold Crackenthorpe at his office, and he and Sergeant Weatherall arrived there punctually. The office was on the fourth floor of a big block of city offices. Inside, everything showed prosperity and the acme of modern business taste. A neat young woman took his name, spoke in a discreet murmur through a telephone, and then, rising, showed them into Harold Crackenthorpe's own private office. Harold was sitting behind a large leather-topped desk and was looking as impeccable and self-confident as ever. If, as the inspector's private knowledge led him to surmise, he was close upon Queer Street, no trace of it showed. He looked up with a frank, welcoming interest. "Good morning, Inspector Craddock. I hope this means that you have some definite news for us at last." "Hardly that, I'm afraid, Mr. Crackenthorpe. It's just a few more questions I'd like to ask." "More questions? Surely by now we have answered everything imaginable." "I dare say it feels like that to you, Mr. Crackenthorpe, but it's just a question of our regular routine."
"Well, what is it this time?" He spoke impatiently.
"I would be glad if you could tell me exactly what you were doing on the afternoon and evening of the 20th of December last. Say, between the hours of 3 p.m. and midnight." Harold Crackenthorpe went an angry shade of plum red.
That seems to be a most extraordinary question to ask me. What does it mean, I should like to know?
Craddock smiled gently. It just means that I should like to know where you were between the hours of 3 p.m. and midnight on Friday the 20th of December.
Why?
It would help to narrow things down.
Narrow them down? You have extra information, then?
We hope that we're getting a little closer, sir.
I'm not at all sure that I ought to answer your question. Not, that is, without having my solicitor present.
That, of course, is entirely up to you, said Craddock. You are not bound to answer any questions, and you have a perfect right to have a solicitor present before you do so.
You are not, let me be quite clear, warning me in any way?
Oh, no, sir. Inspector Craddock looked properly shocked. Nothing of that kind. The questions I am asking you, I am asking of several other people as well. There's nothing directly personal about this. It's just a matter of necessary eliminations.
Well, of course, I'm anxious to assist in any way I can. Let me see now. Such a thing isn't easy to answer offhand, but we are very systematic. Miss Ellis, I expect, can help.
He spoke briefly into one of the telephones on his desk, and almost immediately a streamlined young woman in a well-cut black suit entered with a notebook.
My secretary, Miss Ellis, Inspector Craddock. Now, Miss Ellis, the inspector would like to know what I was doing on the afternoon and evening of, what was the date?
Friday, 20th of December.
Friday, 20th December. I expect you will have some record.
Oh, yes. Miss Ellis left the room, returned with an office memorandum calendar, and turned the pages. You were in the office in the morning of 20th of December. You had a conference with Mr. Goldie about the Cromarty merger. You lunched with Lord Forthville at the Berkeley.
Ah, it was that day, yes.
You returned to the office at about 3 o'clock and dictated half a dozen letters. Then you left to attend Sotheby's sale rooms, where you were interested in some rare manuscripts which were coming up for sale that day. You did not return to the office again, but I have a note to remind you that you were attending the catering club dinner that evening. She looked up interrogatively.
Thank you, Miss Ellis.
Miss Ellis glided from the room.
That is all quite clear in my mind, said Harold. I went to Sotheby's that afternoon, but the items I wanted there went for far too high a price. I had tea in a small place in Jermyn Street, Russell's, I think it is called. I dropped into a news theatre for about half an hour or so, then went home. I live at 43 Cardigan Gardens. The catering club dinner took place at 7:30 at Caterer's Hall, and after it I returned home to bed. I think that should answer your questions.
That's all very clear, Mr. Crackenthorpe. What time was it when you returned home to dress?
I don't think I can remember exactly. Soon after 6, I should think.
And after the dinner?
It was, I think, 11:30 when I got home.
Did your manservant let you in? Or perhaps Lady Alice Crackenthorpe?
My wife, Lady Alice, is abroad in the south of France and has been since early in December. I let myself in with my latchkey.
So there is no one who can vouch for your returning home when you say you did? Harold gave him a cold stare.
I dare say the servants heard me come in. I have a man and wife. But really, Inspector... Please, Mr. Crackenthorpe, I know these kind of questions are annoying, but I have nearly finished.
Do you own a car?
Yes, a Humber Hawk.
You drive it yourself?
Yes. I don't use it much, except at weekends. Driving in London is quite impossible nowadays.
I presume you use it when you go down to see your father and sister at Brackhampton?
Not unless I'm going to stay there for some length of time. If I just go down for the night, as, for instance, to the inquest the other day, I always go by train. There is an excellent train service, and it is far quicker than going by car. The car my sister hires meets me at the station.
Where do you keep your car?
I rent a garage in Mews behind Cardigan Gardens. Any more questions?
I think that's all for now, said Inspector Craddock, smiling and rising. I'm very sorry for having to bother you. When they were outside, Sergeant Weatherall, a man who lived in a state of dark suspicion of all and sundry, remarked meaningly, he didn't like those questions. Didn't like them at all. Put out he was. If you have not committed a murder, it naturally annoys you if someone thinks that you have, said Inspector Craddock mildly. It would particularly annoy an ultra-respectable man like Harold Crackenthorpe. There's nothing in that. What we've got to find out now is if anyone actually saw Harold Crackenthorpe at the sale that afternoon, and the same applies to the tea-shop place. He could easily have travelled by the 4:33, pushed the woman out of the train, and caught a train back to London in time to appear at the dinner. In the same way, he could have driven his car down that night, moved the body to the sarcophagus, and driven back again. Make inquiries in the mews. Yes, sir. Do you think that's what he did do? How do I know? Said Inspector Craddock. He is a tall, dark man. He could have been on that train. And he's got a connection with Rutherford Hall. He's a possible suspect in this case. Now for Brother Alfred. Alfred Crackenthorpe had a flat in West Hampstead, in a big, modern building of slightly jerry-built type, with a large courtyard in which owners of flats parked their cars with a certain lack of consideration for others. The flat was of the modern built-in type, evidently rented furnished. It had a long plywood table that let down from the wall, a divan bed, and various chairs of improbable proportions. Alfred Crackenthorpe met them with engaging friendliness, but was, the inspector thought, nervous. I'm intrigued, he said. Can I offer you a drink, Inspector Craddock? He held up various bottles invitingly. No, thank you, Mr. Crackenthorpe. As bad as that. He laughed at his own little joke, then asked what it was all about. Inspector Craddock said his little piece. What was I doing on the afternoon and evening of the 20th of December? How should I know? Why, that's... what? Over 3 weeks ago. Your brother Harold has been able to tell us very exactly. Now, Brother Harold, perhaps. Not Brother Alfred. He added with a touch of something envious, malice, possibly. Harold is the successful member of the family, busy, useful, fully employed. A time for everything and everything at that time. Even if he were to commit a murder, shall we say, it would be carefully timed and exact. Any particular reason for using that example? Oh, no. It just came into my mind as a supreme absurdity. Now, about yourself. Alfred spread out his hands. It's as I tell you, I have no memory for times or places. If you were to say Christmas Day now, then I should be able to answer you. There's a peg to hang it on. I know where I was Christmas Day. We spend that with my father at Brackhampton. I really don't know why. He grumbles at the expense of having us, and would grumble that we never came near him if we didn't come. We really do it to please my sister. And you did it this year? Yes. But unfortunately, your father was taken ill, was he not? Craddock was pursuing a sideline deliberately, led by the kind of instinct that often came to him in his profession. He was taken ill. Living like a sparrow in the glorious cause of economy, sudden full eating and drinking had its effect. That was all it was it? Of course, what else? I gathered that his doctor was worried. Oh, that old fool Quimper, Alfred spoke quickly and scornfully. It's no use listening to him, Inspector. He's an alarmist of the worst kind. Indeed? He seemed rather a sensible kind of man to me. He's a complete fool. Father's not really an invalid. Nothing wrong with his heart. But he takes Quimper in completely. Naturally, when Father really felt ill, he made a terrific fuss and had Quimper going and coming, asking questions, going into everything he'd eaten and drunk. The whole thing was ridiculous. Alfred spoke with unusual heat. Craddock was silent for a moment or two, rather effectively. Alfred fidgeted, shot him a quick glance, and then said petulantly, "Well, what is all this?"
Why do you want to know where I was on a particular Friday 3 or 4 weeks ago?
So you do remember that it was a Friday? I thought you said so.
Perhaps I did, said Inspector Craddock.
At any rate, Friday the 20th is the day I am asking about.
Why?
It's a routine inquiry.
That's nonsense.
Have you found out something more about this woman?
About where she came from?
Our information is not yet complete.
Alfred gave him a sharp glance. I hope you're not being led aside by this wild theory of Emma's that she might have been my brother Edmund's widow. Oh, that's complete nonsense.
This, Martine did not at any time apply to you?
To me? Good Lord, no. That would have been a laugh.
She would be more likely, you think, to go to your brother Harold?
Oh, much more likely.
His name's frequently in the papers. He's well off. Trying a touch there wouldn't surprise me.
Not that you'd have got anything. Harold's as tight-fisted as the old man himself.
Emma, of course, is the soft-hearted one of the family, and she was Edmund's favourite sister.
All the same, Emma isn't credulous. She was quite alive to the possibility of this woman being phony. She had it all laid on for the entire family to be there, and a hard-headed solicitor as well.
Very wise, said Craddock.
Was there a definite date fixed for this meeting?
It was to be soon after Christmas.
The weekend of the 27th.
He stopped.
Ah, said Craddock pleasantly.
So I see some dates have a meaning to you.
I told you, no definite date was fixed.
But you talked about it when?
I really can't remember.
And you can't tell me what you yourself were doing on Friday the 20th of December.
Sorry, my mind's an absolute blank.
You don't keep an engagement book?
Can't stand the things.
The Friday before Christmas, it shouldn't be too difficult.
I played golf one day with a likely prospect. Alfred shook his head. No, that was the week before. I probably just mooched around. I spend a lot of my time doing that. I find one's business gets done in bars more than anywhere else. Perhaps the people here or some friends of yours may be able to help.
Maybe.
I'll ask them.
Do what I can.
Alfred seemed more sure of himself now. I can't tell you what I was doing that day, he said. But I can tell you what I wasn't doing. I wasn't murdering anyone in the long barn.
Why should you say that, Mr. Crackenthorpe?
Come now, my dear Inspector. You're investigating this murder, aren't you? And when you begin to ask, where were you on such and such a day at such and such a time, you're narrowing down things.
I'd very much like to know why you've hit on Friday the 20th between what, lunchtime and midnight?
It couldn't be medical evidence, not after all this time.
Did somebody see the deceased sneaking into the barn that afternoon? She went in and never came out, etc. Is that it?
The sharp black eyes were watching him narrowly, but Inspector Craddock was far too old a hand to react to that sort of thing.
I'm afraid we'll have to let you guess about that, he said pleasantly.
The police are so secretive.
Not only the police.
I think, Mr. Crackenthorpe, you could remember what you were doing on that Friday if you tried.
Of course, you may have reasons for not wishing to remember.
You won't catch me that way, Inspector.
It's very suspicious, of course, very suspicious indeed, that I can't remember. But there it is.
Wait a minute now. I went to Leeds that week. Stayed at a hotel close to the town hall. Can't remember its name, but you'd find it easily enough.
That might have been on the Friday.
We'll check up, said the inspector unemotionally. He rose.
I'm sorry you couldn't have been more cooperative, Mr. Crackenthorpe.
Most unfortunate for me. There's Cedric with a safe alibi in Ibiza, and Harold, no doubt, checked with business appointments and public dinners every hour. And here am I with no alibi at all. Very sad. And also silly. I've already told you I don't murder people. And why should I murder an unknown woman anyway? What for? Even if the corpse is a corpse of Edmund's widow, why should any of us wish to do away with her? Now, if she'd been married to Harold in the war and had suddenly reappeared, then it might have been awkward for the respectable Harold. Bigamy and all that.
Redmond? Why, we'd all have enjoyed making Father stump up a bit to give her an allowance and send the boy to a decent school. Father would have been wild, but he couldn't in decency refuse to do something. Won't you have a drink before you go, Inspector? Sure? Too bad I haven't been able to help you. Sir, listen, do you know what? Inspector Craddock looked at his excited sergeant. Yes, Weatherall, what is it? I've placed him, sir, that chap. All the time I was trying to fix it, and suddenly it came. He was mixed up in that tin food business with Dickie Rogers. Never got anything on him, too cagey for that. And he's been in with one or more of the Soho lot, watches and that Italian sovereign business. Of course. Craddock realised now why Alfred's face had seemed vaguely familiar from the first. It had all been small-time stuff, never anything that could be proved. Alfred had always been on the outskirts of the racket with a plausible, innocent reason for having been mixed up in it at all. But the police had been quite sure that a small, steady profit came his way. That throws rather a light on things, Craddock said. Think he did it? I shouldn't have said he was the type to do murder, but it explains other things. The reason why he couldn't come up with an alibi. Yes, that looks bad for him. Not really, said Craddock. It's quite a clever line. Just to say firmly, you can't remember. Lots of people can't remember what they did and where they were even a week ago. It's especially useful if you don't particularly want to call attention to the way you spend your time. Interesting rendezvous at lorry pull-ups with the Dickie Rogers crowd, for instance. So you think he's all right? I'm not prepared to think anyone's all right just yet, said Inspector Craddock. You've got to work on it, Weatherall. Back at his desk, Craddock sat frowning and making little notes on the pad in front of him. Murderer, he wrote. A tall, dark man. Victim? Could have been Martine, Edmund Crackenthorpe's girlfriend or widow. Or could have been Anna Stravinska. Went out of circulation at appropriate time, right age and appearance, clothing, etc. No connection with Rutherford Hall as far as is known. Could be Harold's first wife, bigamy. Could be Harold's mistress, blackmail. If connection with Alfred might be blackmail, had knowledge that could have sent him to jail. If Cedric might have had connection with him abroad, Paris, Balearics. Or, victim could be Anna S. posing as Martine, or victim is unknown woman killed by unknown murderer. And most probably the latter, said Craddock aloud. He reflected gloomily on the situation. You couldn't get far with a case until you had a motive. All the motives suggested so far seemed either inadequate or far-fetched. Now, if only it had been the murder of old Mr. Crackenthorpe. He had plenty of motive there. Something stirred in his memory. He made further notes on his pad. Ask Dr. Q about Christmas illness. Cedric, alibi. Consult Miss M for latest gossip. Chapter 16. When Craddock got to 4 Madison Road, he found Lucy Islesbarrow with Miss Marple. He hesitated for a moment on his plan of campaign, and then decided that Lucy Islesbarrow might prove a valuable ally. After greetings, he solemnly drew out his note-case, extracted 3-pound notes, added 3 shillings, and pushed them across the table to Miss Marple.
What's this, Inspector?
Consultation fee. You're a consultant. On murder. Pulse, temperature, local reactions, possible deep-seated cause of said murder. I'm just the poor harassed local GP. Miss Marple looked at him and twinkled. He grinned at her. Lucy Islesbarrow gave a faint gasp and then laughed.
Why, Inspector Craddock, you're human after all.
Oh, well, I'm not strictly on duty this afternoon.
I told you we had met before, said Miss Marple to Lucy. Sir Henry Clithering is his godfather, a very old friend of mine.
Would you like to hear, Miss Islesbarrow, what my godfather said about her the first time we met? He described her as just the finest detective God ever made. Natural genius cultivated in suitable soil. He told me never to despise the... Dermot Craddock paused for a moment to seek for a synonym for old pussies. Elderly ladies. He said they could usually tell you what might have happened, what ought to have happened, and even what actually did happen. And, he said, they can tell you why it happened. He added that this particular, elderly lady was at the top of the class. Well, said Lucy, that seems to be a testimonial, all right. Miss Marple was pink and confused and looked unusually dithery. Dear Sir Henry, she murmured, always so kind. Really, I'm not at all clever, just perhaps a slight knowledge of human nature. Living, you know, in a village. She added with more composure, of course, I am somewhat handicapped by not actually being on the spot. It is so helpful, I always feel, when people remind you of other people, because types are alike everywhere, and that is such a valuable guide. Lucy looked a little puzzled, but Craddock nodded comprehendingly. But you've been to tea there, haven't you? He said. Yes, indeed. Most pleasant. I was a little disappointed that I didn't see old Mr. Crackenthorpe, but one can't have everything. Do you feel that if you saw the person who had done the murder, you'd know? Asked Lucy. Oh, I wouldn't say that, dear. One is always inclined to guess, and guessing would be very wrong when it is a question of anything as serious as murder. All one can do is to observe the people concerned, or who might have been concerned, and see of whom they remind you. Like Cedric and the bank manager. Miss Marple corrected her. The bank manager's son, dear. Mr. Ede himself was far more like Mr. Harold, a very conservative man, but perhaps a little too fond of money. The sort of man, too, who would go a long way to avoid scandal. Craddock smiled and said, And Alfred?
Jenkins at the garage, Miss Marple replied promptly. He didn't exactly appropriate tools, but he used to exchange a broken or inferior jack for a good one. And I believe he wasn't very on the bat about, though I don't understand these things very well. I know Raymond left off dealing with him and went to the garage on the Milchester Road. As for Emma, continued Miss Marple thoughtfully, she reminds me very much of Geraldine Webb. Always very quiet, almost dowdy, and bullied a good deal by her elderly mother. Quite a surprise to everybody when the mother died unexpectedly, and Geraldine came into a nice sum of money and went and had her hair cut and permed and went off on a cruise and came back married to a very nice barrister. They had two children.
The parallel was clear enough. Lucy said rather uneasily, Do you think you ought to have said what you did about Emma marrying? It seemed to upset the brothers. Miss Marple nodded.
Yes, she said. So like men, quite unable to see what's going on under their eyes. I don't believe you noticed yourself.
No, admitted Lucy. I never thought of anything of that kind. They both seemed to me
so old, said Miss Marple, smiling a little. But Dr. Quimper isn't much over 40, I should say, though he's going grey on the temples, and it's obvious that he's longing for some kind of home life. And Emma Crackenthorpe is under 40, or too old to marry and have a family. The doctor's wife died quite young, having a baby, so I have heard.
I believe she did. Emma said something about it one day.
He must be lonely, said Miss Marple. A busy, hard-working doctor needs a wife, someone sympathetic, not too young.
Listen, darling, said Lucy, are we investigating crime or are we matchmaking? Miss Marple twinkled.
I'm afraid I am rather romantic, because I am an old maid, perhaps. You know, dear Lucy, that as far as I'm concerned, you have fulfilled your contract.
If you really want a holiday abroad before taking up your next engagement, you would have time still for a short trip.
And leave Rutherford Hall? Never. I'm the complete sleuth by now, almost as bad as the boys. They spend their entire time looking for clues. They looked all through the dustbins yesterday, most unsavory, and they hadn't really the faintest idea what they were looking for. If they come to you in triumph, Inspector Craddock, bearing a torn scrap of paper with "Martine, if you value your life, keep away from the Long Barn" on it, you'll know that I've taken pity on them and concealed it in the pigsty.
Why the pigsty, dear? Asked Miss Marple with interest. Do they keep pigs?
Oh, no, not nowadays. It's just... I go there sometimes.
For some reason, Lucy blushed. Miss Marple looked at her with increased interest.
Who's at the house now? Asked Craddock.
Cedric's there, and Brian's coming down for the weekend. Harold and Alfred are coming down tomorrow. They rang up this morning. I somehow got the impression that you had been putting the cat among the pigeons, Inspector Craddock.
Craddock smiled. I shook them up a little.
Asked them to account for their movements on Friday the 20th of December.
And could they?
Harold could. Alfred couldn't. Or wouldn't.
I think alibis must be terribly difficult, said Lucy. Times and places and dates. They must be hard to check up on, too.
It takes time and patience, but we manage. He glanced at his watch. I'll be coming along to Rutherford Hall presently to have a word with Cedric, but I want to get hold of Dr. Quimper first.
You'll be just about right. He has his surgery at 6, and he's usually finished about 6:30. I must get back and deal with dinner.
I'd like your opinion on one thing, Miss Islesborough. What's the family view about this Martine business, amongst themselves?
Lucy replied promptly, They're all furious with Emma for going to you about it, and with Dr. Quimper, who it seemed encouraged her to do so. Harold and Alfred think it was a try-on, and not genuine. Emma isn't sure.
Cedric thinks it was phony, too, but he doesn't take it as seriously as the other two. Brian, on the other hand, seems quite sure that it's genuine.
Why, I wonder?
Well, Brian's rather like that. Just accepts things at their face value. He thinks it was Edmund's wife, or rather widow, and that she had suddenly to go back to France, but they'll hear from her again sometime. The fact that she hasn't written or anything up to now seems to him to be quite natural, because he never writes letters himself. Brian's rather sweet, just like a dog that wants to be taken for a walk.
And do you take him for a walk, dear? Asked Miss Marple.
To the pigsties, perhaps?
Lucy shot a keen glance at her.
So many gentlemen in the house coming and going, mused Miss Marple.
When Miss Marple uttered the word gentleman, she always gave it its full Victorian flavour, an echo from an era actually before her own time. You were conscious at once of dashing, full-blooded and probably whiskered males, sometimes wicked, but always gallant.
"You're such a handsome girl," pursued Miss Marple, appraising Lucy. "I expect they pay you a good deal of attention, don't they?"
Lucy flushed slightly. Scrappy remembrances passed across her mind. Cedric leaning against the pigsty wall, Brian sitting disconsolately on the kitchen table, Alfred's fingers touching hers as he helped her collect the coffee cups.
"Gentlemen," said Miss Marple, in the tone of one speaking of some alien and dangerous species, are all very much alike in some ways, even if they are quite old.
"Darling," cried Lucy, 100 years ago you would certainly have been burned as a witch. And she told her the story of old Mr. Crackenthorpe's conditional proposal of marriage.
"In fact," said Lucy, "they've all made what you might call advances to me, in a way."
Harold's was very correct, an advantageous financial position in the city.
I don't think it's my attractive appearance. They must think I know something.
She laughed. But Inspector Craddock did not laugh. Be careful, he said. They might murder you instead of making advances to you.
I suppose it might be simpler, Lucy agreed. Then she gave a slight shiver.
She won't forget, she said.
Been having such fun that one almost thought of it all as a game. But it's not a game.
No, said Miss Marple. Murder isn't a game.
She was silent for a moment or two before she said, Don't the boys go back to school soon?
Yes, next week. They go tomorrow to James Stoddart West's home for the last few days of the holidays.
I'm glad of that, said Miss Marple gravely. I shouldn't like anything to happen while they're there.
You mean to old Mr. Crackenthorpe? Do you think he's going to be murdered next?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. He'll be all right. I meant to the boys.
To the boys?
Well, to Alexander.
But surely...
Hunting about, you know, looking for clues. Boys love that sort of thing, but it might be very dangerous.
Craddock looked at her thoughtfully. You're not prepared to believe, are you, Miss Marple, that it's a case of an unknown woman murdered by an unknown man? You tie it up definitely with Rutherford Hall.
I think there's a definite connection, yes.
All we know about the murderer is that he's a tall, dark man. That's what your friend says, and all she can say. There are three tall, dark men at Rutherford Hall. On the day of the inquest, you know, I came out to see the three brothers standing waiting on the pavement for the car to draw up. They had their backs to me, and it was astonishing how, in their heavy overcoats, they looked all alike. Three tall, dark men. And yet, actually, they're all three quite different types. He sighed. It makes it very difficult.
I wonder, murmured Miss Marple, I have been wondering whether it might perhaps be all much simpler than we suppose. Murders so often are quite simple, with an obvious, rather sordid motive.
Do you believe in the mysterious Martine, Miss Marple?
I'm quite ready to believe that Edmund Crackenthorpe either married or meant to marry a girl called Martine. Emma Crackenthorpe showed you his letter, I understand, and from what I've seen of her and from what Lucy tells me, I should say Emma Crackenthorpe is quite incapable of making up a thing of that kind. Indeed, why should she?
So, granted Martine, said Craddock thoughtfully. There is a motive of a kind. Martine's reappearance with a son would diminish the Crackenthorpe inheritance. Though hardly to a point one would think to activate murder. They're all very hard up.
Even Harold? Lucy demanded incredulously.
Even the prosperous-looking Harold Crackenthorpe is not the sober and conservative financier he appears to be. He's been plunging heavily and mixing himself up in some rather undesirable ventures. A large sum of money, soon, might avoid a crash.
But if so, said Lucy and stopped.
Yes, Miss Islesborough.
I know, dear, said Miss Marple. The wrong murder, that's what you mean.
Yes. Martine's death wouldn't do Harold or any of the others any good. Not until
Luther Crackenthorpe died.
Exactly.
That occurred to me. And Mr. Crackenthorpe Senior, I gather from his doctor, has a much better life than any outsider would imagine.
He'll last for years, said Lucy. Then she frowned.
Yes, Craddock spoke encouragingly.
He was rather ill at Christmas time, said Lucy. He said the doctor made a lot of fuss about it. Anyone would have thought I'd been poisoned by the fuss he made. That's what he said.
She looked inquiringly at Craddock.
Yes, said Craddock. That's really what I want to ask Dr. Quimper about.
Well, I must go, said Lucy. Heavens, it's late.
Miss Marple put down her knitting and picked up the Times with a half-done crossword puzzle.
I wish I had a dictionary here, she murmured. Tontine and Tokai. I always mix those two words up. One, I believe, is a Hungarian wine.
That's Tokai, said Lucy, looking back from the door. But one's a five-letter word and one's seven. What's the clue?
Oh, it wasn't in the crossword, said Miss Marple vaguely. It was in my head. Inspector Craddock looked at her very hard. Then he said goodbye and went. Chapter 17. Craddock had to wait a few minutes whilst Quimper finished his evening surgery, and then the doctor came to him. He looked tired and depressed. He offered Craddock a drink, and when the latter accepted, he mixed one for himself as well. "Poor devils," he said, as he sank down in a worn easy chair. "So scared and so stupid. No sense. Had a painful case this evening. Woman who ought to have come to me a year ago. If she'd come then, she might have been operated on successfully. Now it's too late. Makes me mad. The truth is, people are an extraordinary mixture of heroism and cowardice. She's been suffering agony and borne it without a word just because she was too scared to come and find out that what she feared might be true. At the other end of the scale are the people who come and waste my time because they've got a dangerous swelling causing them agony on their little finger, which they think may be cancer and which turns out to be a common or garden chilblain. Well, don't mind me. I've blown off steam now. What did you want to see me about? First, I've got you to thank, I believe, for advising Miss Crackenthorpe to come to me with the letter that purported to be from her brother's widow. Oh, that. Anything in it? I didn't exactly advise her to come. She wanted to. She was worried. All the dear little brothers were trying to hold her back, of course. Why should they? The doctor shrugged his shoulders. Afraid the lady might be proved genuine, I suppose. Do you think the letter was genuine? No idea. Never actually saw it. I should say it was someone who knew the facts, just trying to make a touch, hoping to work on Emma's feelings. They were dead wrong there. Emma's no fool. She wouldn't take an unknown sister-in-law to her bosom without asking a few practical questions first. He added with some curiosity, "But why ask my views? I've got nothing to do with it." "I really came to ask you something quite different, but I don't quite know how to put it." Dr. Quimper looked interested. "I understand that not long ago, at Christmas time, I think it was, Mr. Crackenthorpe had rather a bad turn of illness." He saw a change at once in the doctor's face. It hardened. "Yes. I gather a gastric disturbance of some kind." "Yes. This is difficult. Mr. Crackenthorpe was boasting of his health, saying he intended to outlive most of his family. He referred to you. You'll excuse me, Doctor. Oh, don't mind me. I'm not sensitive as to what my patients say about me. He spoke of you as an old fusspot." Quimper smiled. "He said you had asked him all sorts of questions, not only as to what he had eaten, but as to who prepared it and served it."
End of Disc 4.